All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing writer Natasha Bogutsky.
And sitting across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. So, Rich, I hear that we got some really good news this week. Out of the Cannes Film Festival.
Yes, we did. Finally, after 20 years of working and struggling and setbacks and cast changes and rewrites and everything else, Terry Gilliam finally got The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, his longtime passion project, finished and screened in front of audiences. People have actually now seen his movie that he's been struggling to bring to people for 20 years. And when I got up this morning, like one of the first things I do, because, you know, it's kind of a lazy Sunday morning, I picked up my phone and opened up Twitter, and literally the first image was a 30-second video of Gilliam receiving a standing ovation at Cannes after this first public screening of the film. And I was just like, it was very emotional to me. I'm a big Terry Gilliam fan for years. I've been rooting for him to get this project done. You know, very mad at the universe, at all the horseshit it's thrown at him over these years as he's trying to get it done. And just to see that and to see him basking in everybody's congratulations for finishing that film and recognizing, you know, all that he's gone through and everything, it was an emotional moment for me as well. I got a little choked up, I'll say that.
I haven't followed it, obviously, as you have over these years, but I was aware of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, and I was aware of some of the setbacks it has had over the years.
I would recommend, for a primer on the first big giant collapse of the project, I would recommend checking out the documentary Lost in La Mancha, which was actually shot on the location, on sets, during the first and only week of production, the first time Gilliam tried to make this film back in 2000 with Johnny Depp in the lead. And just watching the cascade of bad luck is just sickening and disheartening to watch. It's one of the, if you're a film lover and if you're a Terry Gilliam fan, it's going to be one of the saddest films you will ever watch.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Mm-hmm. But I am very proud now that he has been able to screen this, given all the setbacks. And if you've been listening to the podcast over the past few weeks, you will have noticed that we have brought up in the news several times that there was another setback in the form of a lawsuit from a former producer, shall we say.
Former person who promised to be a producer and then actually never gave any money.
Yeah.
And then thinks he now owns the film, is how I would phrase that. But
okay. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I was trying to be nice and not wordy about it.
This guy doesn't deserve niceness. I'm sorry. This guy is a predatory dick, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey.
Come at me. Sue me. Sue me for my net worth of what? $17? Woo.
You might want to leave that part out.
Nah, we'll see.
But
and I mean, I've been a Terry Gilliam fan literally since before I was a Monty Python fan. I discovered Gilliam as a kid when Time Bandits came out, and I was just like, this is an amazing film. And that was just right around my awakening about movie making and things like that. So, you know, I tracked down, Terry Gilliam. Okay, who's this guy? Oh, he's made one other movie, Jabberwocky, you know, which it took me forever to find a copy of.
Really?
Yes, he made Jabberwocky.
No, I knew that. It took you forever to find a copy of that? I saw that before Monty Python as a kid.
Well, normally I don't play this card, but in my time,
God.
Yeah, the video stores weren't as prevalent as they were at, you know, when I first saw Time Bandits, as they were when you were the same age.
Yeah, I was the Blockbuster generation. I had all the Blockbusters.
Yes, I was a little pre-Blockbuster. You didn't get mom and pop video stores, you know, really exploding until, you know, my sophomore, junior year of high school, when right around the mid to late 80s, right as the home VCR explosion was also obviously happening. So, you know, Time Bandits predated that by a couple of years. So it took me a couple of years before I could track down a copy of Jabberwocky to be able to see it to even.
Poor you.
Oh, this is how this is going to go today.
Well, I haven't seen Time Bandits, so throw it back at me.
Oh, yeah. Come on. That is just a fantastic film. I still love it. It's part of the Criterion Collection, so, you know.
Now I'll have to track it down.
There you go.
Isn't Jabberwocky Criterion?
I don't believe so.
I thought I saw it on the wall at Barnes & Noble.
Now I'm going to take a quick moment here to check here.
I'm almost certain it is. If it's not, I'll eat my hat. Oh, wait.
You didn't wear a hat today.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yes, it is. Good call.
So if you want a copy of it, Rich, just drive up to our local Barnes & Noble and pick up one.
I will. It's spine number 977. Mm-hmm. For those of you who catalog your criterions that way. And if you do, you're a monster. It should be alphabetical, for goodness sake.
I still categorize everything alphabetically, all my movies.
Same here. I can't do any other system. I'll break out some certain categories. Like, you'll notice I have my criterions all on their own shelf. My non-Region 1 DVDs over by themselves.
Your box sets by themselves.
Yeah, box sets with mixed titles.
I did notice, though, you do mix your foreign films in with your regular films, so...
Yeah.
You don't separate by genre, you just separate by format.
Yeah, I do. You know, DVDs are separate from Blu-rays, and then all the subcategorization is replicated both places.
Yes, as your Marvel films, everything up to Ant-Man is sitting on one shelf.
Yeah, I do. Okay, there are a couple of series I broke out. Godzilla, Ant-Man, and classic Universal horror films.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of classic Universal horror films, how's this for a transition?
Oh, I love that. That was actually really good. That was just coincidental.
I know. We did not plan that one. We're just that good, ladies and gentlemen. It looks like the Universal's Dark Universe franchise, their proposed franchise that was going to see new versions of all their classic monsters acting in a self-contained, interconnected universe, might not be so dead as we thought.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, damn it. Oh, no, why am I saying that? That means more Russell Crowe for me.
Yes.
Yay.
Okay, then. Yeah, last summer, their inaugural film in the franchise, The Mummy, was met with some pretty bad reviews, and rightly so. And everybody was like, well, that's what you get for putting your franchise plans ahead of your making a good movie plan, which I think there's a false equivalency there at some point, that you can have big franchise plans and still make good movies. I mean, that's what Marvel does. But everybody was like, well, this pretty much kills this plan. And a few months later, when the follow-up film, Bride of Frankenstein, got indefinitely delayed, everybody just assumed, well, that's it. It's over and done with. And I'm pulling up the story off of Film Buff Online, written by our wonderful comic book movie editor, Bill Gadavaskis. Turns out that Los Angeles mural artist Robert Vargas had a meeting on the Universal lot and then posted something to Instagram, said, great meeting this morning with the amazing hashtag Dark Universe team. Thank you, Universal execs, Holly, Galine, and Crash for the hospitality. Looking forward to contributing to the Universal Pictures legacy with my work. Monster things are in the works. Stay tuned.
With a winky face.
Winky face. Oh, yeah, sorry. Winky emoji. So definitely this does sound as if Universal's Dark Universe is not quite as dead as we thought. Like a Frankenstein monster, it's shambling back to life, maybe. You don't sound too enthused about the concept in general.
No, I'm scrolling down later on in this article that I found with that quote. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that at one point, screenwriter Ed Solomon was going to write the Invisible Man movie that would star Johnny Depp as the titular character.
Yes.
And I'm sitting there going, that is, for me, the worst casting imaginable for the Invisible Man.
Why so?
Actually, maybe now with his status, it's the perfect casting.
Yeah, this way, if he's invisible, we don't have to see him acting all wonky and goofy. We can just hear it. I know. I mean, they had a lot of plans. They had writers assigned to a number of projects. Bill Condon was selected to direct Bride of Frankenstein. Angelina Jolie and Javier Bardem were going to be in that. You know, I'm always anxious to see any kind of experimentation with storytelling, like basically the Marvel Universe is. So when they announced the Universal's, you know, plan, I was like, oh, that sounds like that could be fun. Kind of link them together with the Russell Crowe character as Dr. Jekyll, heading up a team of people that watch over these kind of things. Sounded like a lot of fun. And depending on, you know, who you believe, there was a whole lot of problems on the production side of The Mummy during shooting that led to the movie being quite the mess that it is. So hopefully at some point we will hear some more. I would like to see them maybe do some course correction. I think, you know, there's still enough of an interesting idea there to salvage.
As long as they keep Russell Crowe, I'll be happy.
Okay, then.
If you haven't figured out by now, I'm a huge Russell Crowe fan, and I have been since I was 5 years old, so come at me.
I'm not going to come at you at all. He's a great actor.
But whilst it has been a light week for film news, the same can't be said about the trailers.
Wow, yeah.
How many do we have to talk about today, Rich?
We've got 5 trailers we're going to take a look at in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I love singing and dancing. Hiya, folks!
For 50 cents, I'll suck your dick.
Well, it's a great price. It almost makes me wish I had a dick for you to suck.
Oh, I'll take that as a yes.
Two of the most decorated offices in this department. What do you see?
Looks like a robbery gone wrong to me.
This wasn't a robbery, this was a hit.
What the?
Someone out there is killing puppets.
Hey, handsome.
You looking for some rotten cotton?
I'm a woman.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's even better.
We've got a good time for you.
We're gonna catch the bastards who did these murders.
Because bodies are gonna start piling up.
You're one of the best damn cops I've ever seen.
I'll have your badge for this. I'm in the fucking FBI.
Oh, yeah? What's that stand for? Fucking big idiot?
And that was just a few moments from the first Very Red Band trailer for The Happy Time Murders, Brian Henson's latest film, one that he's been trying to get made for about 10 years now, since the script first showed up on the blacklist back in 2008. So, Natasha, what'd you think?
This is not a family film.
I would think the R rating that this invariably will have is probably going to hopefully keep parents from taking their kids. But then again, parents are stupid these days. So
I know that you guys didn't hear it in the trailer audio that we dropped in, but sit down, watch the trailer, stick around for the end scene. I never wanted to see that.
Are you listening, Academy? Just remember this when it comes time for Oscar nominations.
No. Hell no. But was the one of the guys there, that was one of them was from The Office. The other one was from Community, right?
Yeah, that was Joel McHale.
And then we had, what's her name?
Melissa McCarthy, of course,
lead. Not Melissa, the other one from Bridesmaids.
Maya Rudolph.
Thank you, Maya.
As the secretary.
I haven't decided whether or not I actually want to see this and ruin my childhood, or if I want to see it because, well, hell, I lost my innocence a long time ago.
Well, either way,
Looks like it's fun.
Look for our review in August for this one.
Yeah.
That sounds like it's going to be a fun talk.
Mm-hmm.
What's also going to be an interesting talk when we do get to see it is the next Spike Lee movie, which has already been getting some rave reviews out of Cannes, and it's called Black Klansman.
There's never been a black cop in this city. We think you might be the man to open things up around here.
Hello, this is Ron Stallworth calling.
Who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
God. Last time I checked. What can I do for
him? Well, since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews, Mexicans and Irish, Italians and Chinese. But my mouth to God's ears, I really hate those black rats. And anyone else, really, that doesn't have pure white Aryan blood running through their veins.
I'm happy to be talking to a true white American.
God bless white America.
The KKK is planning an attack.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
We'll establish contact over the phone.
We'll need a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
You for the white race, Ron?
Oh, hell yeah.
So there becomes a combined
Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
With the right white man, we can do anything.
And those were just a few brief moments from the newest Spike Lee film, Black Klansman, which will be coming out soon. Can we just talk for a second about Topher Grace's That 70s Show transition?
Well, this movie's set in the 70s, so I'm good with that. But yeah, he's a far, far removed from the G-shucks, golly gee whiz nice guy that he played on that show.
Yeah.
Kind of icky, but good for him.
I'm going to definitely say I'm seeing this film when it comes out.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, usually a Spike Lee film is cause to go see. And I like what this trailer does. It sort of almost feels like a blaxploitation trailer in the first 30 seconds or so. You've got some funk music and, you know, you've got a couple of things that just feel very 70s, you know, blaxploitation genre feel to it.
And then it switches gears.
And then it kind of slowly switches gears, yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, of course, this is Spike Lee. He's not going to make just a straight-up blaxploitation film. There's going to be some different subtext and things going on in there. Mm-hmm. Until by the time we get a bunch of Klansmen in the 1970s saying, you know, America first, well, we pretty much know what he's going for.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. then on top of it, you know, there's a hell of a cast in this.
Oh, yeah.
I will be seeing it just for Adam Driver alone, but I really, really actually want to see this movie.
Oh, I know. Adam Driver, he's been having a hell of a career for, what, he's barely 35, and he's worked with a lot of great directors already. He really knows how to pick his projects.
As he is the lead in The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Yes.
And we just went back to news.
Yeah, so he's worked with Gilliam, he's worked with Spike Lee, he's worked with J.J. Abrams, he's worked
Spielberg.
With Ryan. He's worked with Spielberg, he's worked with Rian Johnson. He's getting a pretty good resume going for himself there.
And can we also talk about that the love interest from Spider-Man Homecoming is in this and does not look like a teenager? It's actually kind of eerie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a bunch of those actors are right there on that cusp of where they can kind of move back and forth. You know, there's like that certain sweet spot where you can, I can sort of convincingly play a teenager and get away with it and still within like the same year or two come back out and play, you know, a young person and a young adult in their like early to mid 20s and kind of like skate that little thin line back and forth. It's, you know, you don't get much of a chance to do it, but, you know, she's doing it right here, and which is nice. And I, you know, I'm anxious to actually see some more of her work because, I mean, they gave her a nice part in Spider-Man Homecoming, but it wasn't really super meaty.
No, it really wasn't. It was just,
she did well with
you're
it.
You're there.
Mm-hmm. But Spike Lee isn't the only socially conscious director who is offering up a new trailer this week. We have something new from Rob Reiner, and it's his look at the newspaper industry right around the time of the Iraq invasion after 9/11 in the feature Shock and Awe.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
They're dialing up the rhetoric on Iraq. Let's see if we can nail them down, okay? Let's get to work.
We're working on a theory that the administration has already decided to go to war and is now focused on how to justify it.
It's not a theory.
We're working on something important. That's why I'm here, to make you an offer.
It's Joe Galloway.
Wow.
Man even walks like he has a Bronze Star.
What do you want to know?
Everything the administration doesn't want us to know.
A secret war planning group has been set up in the building where I work.
And which building is that?
The one with five sides.
How real is the chatter about Iraq?
Barry, are you looking into an Iraqi connection?
No one's actually come out and said anything publicly. Maybe it's just backroom speculation.
Can't we hit it harder than this?
I know that a man named Ahmed Chalabi wants to replace Saddam Hussein, that the neocons are pushing for the invasion, and you are quickly becoming my favorite writer. Don't
let me down. Proof is coming from every major media outlet in the country, except yours.
Certainly, all right, aren't we?
I'm speaking to you because I'm an American citizen, and I don't like what these people are doing.
You gotta see this.
What do we do?
When the government says something, you only have one question to ask. Is it true?
Well, we love a good newspaper movie here at Film Buff Online and the Big Picture Podcast. And damn, does this look like it's going to be a good newspaper film.
I'm freaking seeing this movie.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, this trailer definitely does its job. And not just because it's telling the story of, well, a very important story about how the lies of the Bush administration that got us into the Iraq War were unraveled, but just because it looks like it's powerfully done. It's got a hell of a cast. You got Woody Harrelson. You got James Marsden. Rob Reiner is directing as well as giving himself a supporting role. I'm fine with that. Jessica Biel, Mila Jovovich, Tommy Lee Jones.
And Richard Schiff.
I know, yes!
Toby's back doing political stuff. He left The Good Doctor, but yet, yay.
Actually, Richard Schiff is always a very political actor. And
yeah, he is.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing a rewatch of The West Wing. And literally, I have like watched 3 episodes one evening, turned it off, and flipped over to one of the news talk shows that evening. And he was a guest. And my immediate first thought was, oh, what's Toby doing on the... No, 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 that's Richard Schiff. It's not Toby. Because he brought that same intensity to that he brought to the character of Toby on West Wing to what he was discussing with the host. And it was just one of those weird moments where, you know, life and art kind of collided in my brain in a weird way.
Is it bad that when I saw that Richard Schiff was in Shock and Awe, I was keeping my eyes peeled on the background actors, hoping that we were going to have a mini West Wing reunion somewhere. I was
Allison
very...
Allison Janney walk through the background or
yes.
Something like that. Yeah, that would be awesome!
When at the Oscars this year, when Allison Janney got up to accept her Best Supporting Academy Award, they did a small cut to Bradley Whitford mm-hmm. sitting in the audience. Yep. So I'm like... Oh, they're going to have a hell of a reunion later on at the Vanity Fair party.
True. True. But yeah. And also, I think it's not just telling a story about what happened post 9/11 and the newspaper's role in and the press's role in dispelling certain lies that were being told to get us into that war. I think it also definitely has a resonance now about the importance of the Fourth Estate. In questioning the government. And let's face it, that part of our democratic process has been under attack from the executive branch and, more accurately, one party.
Alternative facts.
Yes, things like alternative facts. And I think this is kind of a movie that's going to, you know, kind of reassert, no, this is what the press does. And if you don't like the questions they're asking of you or the things that they're saying about you, maybe you should stop doing that. Maybe you should stop doing things that cause these questions to be asked. My two cents.
Well, here's a question for you.
Okay.
The Academy seems to love newspaper movies just about as much as we do.
Yep.
Cue the Spotlight Big Short argument that we have been having for the past couple of years. Do you think we'll be seeing this one come award season?
Oh, most definitely. Unless for some reason this movie just... completely shits the bed, which I don't see it happening, given all the talent involved. This definitely seems like an awards contender. And that makes me a little leery, though. And I'll tell you why. Because I think the people that this film should be speaking to kind of convince them or to make the argument that the press has a vital and important role in asking tough questions.
Tends to avoid award season films.
Tends to avoid award season films, yep. also probably is not going to take too kindly to being preached to by the Hollywood types. Hopefully this film will not wind up just preaching to the choir.
Can I preach for a second and ask you never to do that voice ever again?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, the problem is a lot of the little independent films are the ones that do have these messages in because they know that you can't find them in the big blockbuster movies. They don't sell to a mainstream audience. They're more worried about getting their numbers in with the big action sequences than they are about giving some sort of substance to their films, some sort of message.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the things I loved so much about Black Panther, is it really did have an underlying message in there.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is the film that proves that blockbusters can have these big things. Then again, I believe it was Louis B. Mayer who famously said, you know, make a movie. If you want to send a message, use Western Union. So it's kind of a weird balance because sometimes, you know, people are not going to want a message or they're closed off to a message. And that's what makes it hard, because obviously you want your movie to appeal and to as broad an audience as possible because it's show business. So message versus art is always a weird balancing act that a lot of filmmakers have to do if they want to include a message in their art.
For me, I find that some of the best films actually do contain messages. I mean, I can sit down and watch a mindless action movie, with the exception of the Fast and Furious franchise.
which I am going to get you to watch one day.
Like hell.
I'm going to get you to watch at least one or two of them.
I've seen the first three up to Tokyo Drift. I'm done. Thank you very much.
But it gets better with four.
No.
I swear it does.
It'll be a cold day in hell before I sit down and I watch any more of those movies. They were a waste of time for me to begin with. But it's the films that resonate with me that have some sort of underlying message that carries that film forward, that in 10 years, in 15 years, people may not remember it, but that message is still relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pull that film out at any time, stick it in your DVD player, and guess what? You're not going to have to worry about the action sequences feeling dated. Hence, I know it's a classic, but I am going to bust a little on Star Wars. As a Star Wars fan, I am allowed to do that. You sit down and you watch the original films and you think, mm-hmm. Oh, God, these action sequences. While they were great at the time period, they're cheesy as hell now. And it's the same watching one of my favorites, Big Trouble in Little China. I showed it to the kids for the first time a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going, what the hell is going on here? This looks absolutely ridiculous.
That's sort of the point, though. Big Trouble in Little China was kind of like a love letter to Shaw Brothers action films from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, but they didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I did. You did. They didn't. But
I was going to say, I could loan you a stack of DVDs to bring those kids up to date on. Okay, here's Five Deadly Venoms. Here's 36 Chambers of Shaolin. Here's this. Here's that. You know,
it took me forever for them to get them to sit down and watch Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon mm-hmm. with me. Okay, I'm making baby steps here. Okay,
okay.
Baby steps.
Understand.
But it's the films with messages that still resonate with audiences 20 years from now that, while they didn't appeal to a broad audience, are still relevant
mm-hmm.
and are going to last.
Yeah, and this probably will as well. And may I also say, this is probably the only place where any discussion of Shock and Awe wound up with a Big Trouble in Little China reference.
I'm pretty certain.
This is a big, big picture we bring you. And moving on, our next trailer is actually from another person who I've been a fan of for many, many, many a year. And I'm always anxious and excited to see something new from him.
And this is when I take a back seat.
Yes. It's the first trailer for the new Jackie Chan film, Bleeding Steel.
Hello?
Agent Lin, you are the best I have to transfer Dr. James to a secure military base.
We can't let him get this.
Take
Dr. James called him Andre. He was an experimental subject.
The world's first super bio warrior. I feel like you've turned me into a monster. You're gonna suffer everything I've suffered. Go.
Yes, sir.
We don't have much time.
All my work is in her body. She must be protected.
What Andre needs is Nancy's mechanical heart.
Andre can make an army.
As long as she lives, I will protect her.
Kill him.
Nancy's gone. This is more serious than you know.
And that crazy mess of a trailer is the first look we're having at Jackie Chan's new film, Bleeding Steel. And, well, I always do love Jackie Chan movies, if only to see what kind of set pieces he's trying to build in terms of stunts and action, because he's always trying to top himself. And there looks to be maybe a couple of interesting things in there, including a fight on top of the Sydney Opera House, of all places, because that's where you just happen to get into fights. This definitely is a movie that he shot in Hong Kong because there's some lower production value to it. There's a couple of effect shots that didn't look too great, honestly. It looks like a crazy mess of a movie based on this crazy mess of a trailer. I don't know what's going on for the most part outside of some doctor has created some kind of new artificial heart and some bad guy who looks like Darth Vader without his helmet wants it. And I'll go see it.
I'm glad you brought up that he looked like Darth Vader, because I wanted to say that, but I was afraid that you would slap me.
I would never slap you.
Can we talk about the fact that...
on mic.
On mic. Wow. The crazy white black-haired chick that he's fighting with on top of the Sydney Opera House is actually written here, listed in the cast, as Woman in Black, in brackets, Lady Fidget Spinners. Not kidding.
Maybe there's a scene where we see her with fidget spinners. Maybe she uses fidget spinners as a murder weapon. It's a Jackie Chan film. Who knows? Mm-hmm. And also, it could be a weird translation from Cantonese or something. Like I said, I'll go see it. I honestly think Jackie Chan's best days are behind him. That doesn't mean he's going to turn out automatically bad work, but this is not, you know, Police Story or Crime Story or Project A or, you know, when he was really at the height of his game.
If this was actually what it appeared to look like in the first 10, 15 seconds of the trailer, you might have actually got me over, because as bad as his last movie, what was it called? It wasn't The Informer, was it? No. Crap. I can't remember. The one we did with Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, yeah. That thing.
And that you try to forget about.
The Foreigner. Yes.
As bad as a movie as that was, it mm-hmm. actually had me interested, because it was more of... The trailer made it look more of a dramatic... Not so much an action movie for Jackie Chan. His segue into dramatic roles. Mm-hmm. So within the 15 seconds of Bleeding Steel, I'm sitting here going, okay, maybe I'm interested.
It's a dramatic police story.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden,
crazy science fiction elements pop up.
And then you got muddled of what time period is this actually in? Are we going more for a Man of Steel, visitors from outer space feel? I couldn't tell what the hell was going on. And then you completely lost me.
And then you have the big giant airship. It's not a SHIELD helicarrier, but it darn well looks like it could be.
Sequence on top of Sydney Opera House actually was a turnoff for me.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
Well, like I said, it felt out of character with it from what I saw in the first 15 seconds of the trailer that had me interested. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those, oh, here we go again. Jackie Chan just being the action star again. I want to see something more from him.
He has done some, you know, more straight dramatical things. It's just they don't get as much distribution outside of Asia as this stuff does. You know, I honestly, there's a point where I was kind of like, you know, Jackie, maybe we should just retire completely out of the action genre. He had talked about doing that for a while, and I guess he changed his mind. Every time there's a new Jackie Chan film in production, I always get a little nervous at this point that he's going to hurt himself in a way that is going to, you know, negatively impact his health.
Yeah, I mean, he's what, 70, 72, 76?
Jeepers, he's not that old. He can't be that old. Can he?
Oh, he's 64. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
But even so, 64 is... I will give him credit. He does look like he's mid-50s
mm-hmm.
at this point. So I do give him credit for still looking so young. But yeah, he's starting to get up there. But I've been noticing that a lot lately about in Hollywood, main stars of like action sagas are getting older. I mean, Liam Neeson, he's still going strong in his action hero genre. And I'm not the biggest fan of the work he's been pumping out as of late.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think who else. There's... obviously Stallone.
Mm-hmm.
Even Josh Brolin is starting to join that except he's picking good material.
True. True. He's joining the craggly old action movie club.
Yeah, but like I said, he's at least picking good material. And of course, Bruce Willis is reigning king. But again, he also picks good material. Minus Death Wish.
Ooh.
I had to. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's quite understandable.
There is one thing that I will state for Jackie Chan, unlike Bruce Willis or Liam Neeson or anything, mm-hmm. he's a legend.
True.
And maybe in a couple years, because of his notoriety, maybe I'd like to see a Jackie Chan biopic. I'd like to be proven wrong about some of the ideas that I mm-hmm. think about him.
Well, he did do a movie about his early days in a Chinese opera company and growing up and things like that. But I think it was called Peking Opera Blues, if memory serves. I would love to see a full-on biopic treatment of his life or that time period, at least leading up to his first major film roles. That would be great.
Yeah, it would.
And another biopic that a lot of people have been waiting for a long time, it's been in development forever, is finally ready to go and dropped its first trailer this week. So let's take a look at the first official look at Bohemian Rhapsody.
So now what?
This is when the operatic section comes in.
Oh, the operatic section, yeah.
Mamma mia, mamma mia!
Mamma mia, let me go! Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me, for me, for me!
It goes on forever, 6 bloody minutes.
I pity your wife if you think 6 minutes is forever.
And those are the first few moments from Bohemian Rhapsody, the new Queen/Freddie Mercury biopic that I have been waiting for almost like 10 years at least. Although back then I had handpicked Jim Caviezel.
Nice choice.
Thank you. I think Rami Malek is a much better pick.
Oh, yes. he really seems to embody Freddie Mercury. It probably helps that he's lip syncing along to actual Freddie Mercury recordings instead of doing his own singing.
I heard that what they did was he is singing and they blended the two voices together.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. If that's the case, then wow. One thing I really like about this trailer is how it edits different Queen songs and mixes them together.
Oh, God.
Yes. You get a bit of the We Are the Champions foot stomp clap thing mixed in with Bohemian Rhapsody and things like that. And for somebody who's, you know, listened to Queen's music for a very long time, I'm just like, really, that was kind of like a revelation of how those things kind of melded almost, you know, so perfectly mm-hmm. together. And then I was just like, oh my God. You know, I think I watched the trailer like two or three times just for the music. And I don't know if the soundtrack is going to replicate that idea or if this was just for the trailer. But it certainly speaks to somebody knowing the music really well. And it's going to incorporate it fairly well. That said.
Yes.
Turns out some people weren't so happy with this trailer.
Oh, yeah. That's a thing that mm-hmm. happened. The Independent out of the UK put out an article 3 days ago stating that Bohemian Rhapsody trailer has sparked controversy for ignoring Freddie Mercury's sexuality, which is complete and utter bullshit. I said that because it's British. Anyway.
Explain yourself then.
At one point in the trailer, it is a quick shot, but we do get a shot of Freddie Mercury sitting down while another man is standing in front of him. And he is reaching up this man's thighs.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's going to completely ignore it. It just, that shot happens to fly by so quick that it can be easily missed.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I know the trailers also come under attack for not mentioning AIDS. And yes. I think, honestly, this is the first time that anybody's complained that a trailer did not give away the ending to a movie. Because I'm just like, guys, I think we all know the whole story here. It doesn't have to give all of that away in the trailer.
No.
Even if we do know it.
Yes. Because we're going to get there sooner or later. Yeah. And to be honest, I don't need to see that. I mean, it would be good, but AIDS doesn't resonate the way it once did.
So you don't need to see it in the trailer or in the movie?
In the movie.
Well, I think it's kind of an important part of his life, or right there towards the end, at least. I mean, informs, like, his last recordings.
I believe that we should get his last recordings, but I don't want to see Freddie Mercury die on screen, even if it's not actually Freddie Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with maybe them telling him, look, you're HIV positive. Maybe we see him start to go downhill a bit, do his final recordings. And maybe at one point they say, that's a wrap on, I don't know, toss me out one of his final songs. If you can remember any.
Oh, gosh.
But you get what I'm saying, yeah. Right? So it's a very happy moment. Maybe he smiles knowing that even when he's gone, they have this to remember him by. And maybe that's when it cuts to black and we get Freddie Mercury passed away on such and such date. Queen has been forever remembered as one of the most iconic bands of all time, and his music has inspired an entire generation of musicians or something like that. I want to see the fulfillment in his eyes, not the down spiral of I'm going to die.
So like maybe end the film on the note of him, you know, obviously, you know, combating this disease and
giving
recording the show must go on.
Yes.
Okay. I could see that.
Yeah. Something that is going to reflect that he knows that over generations to come are still going to look back and remember him, and they're going to remember him for something worthwhile that he did. They're not going to remember him as another victim of the AIDS epidemic.
Okay. Okay, I like that. That's fine. My big complaint is people are complaining about it without the movie actually coming out, which is, you know, everybody complains about trailers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, they didn't show Venom, or they didn't show this, or they didn't show that, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, calm down. We're looking at, what, 2 minutes, a minute and a half of a movie that's probably going to run 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
So, obviously, they can't cram everything in.
And the cast itself.
And if they did, you'd complain. Brilliant.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Great cast.
Would you like to take the cast, or should I take the cast?
I think you have the list up, so you go with it.
No, Didn't.
Oh, okay. That okay, was you trying no, to I pan do. It off him. Okay.
Rami Malek, obviously, as Freddie Mercury from Mr. Robot. We have Mike Myers is in this in some unspecified role. He's not in the trailer. We don't get a shot of him.
I believe he's playing one of Queen's managers.
Oh, that would be awesome. Alan Leach, I'm a big Downton Abbey fan. And if you guys are big Downton Abbey fans as well, you'll remember him as Tom Branson, who was the chauffeur that ended up marrying one of the Crowley daughters and becoming a permanent part of the family even after his wife passes away. So it kind of showed that, you know, someone from the Irish lower class could still become a part of this this aristocracy. Tom Hollander, which for you memesters out there is the guy from Pirates of the Caribbean who liked to walk down the ship just as everything was blowing up around him. Aidan Gillen, for you big Game of Thrones fans out there who... I think he played, what was his name? Littlefinger, Peter Baelish, who just got his throat slit in the last season. So at least we know he moved on to better things. And for you, Rich, Lucy Boynton.
Lucy Boynton playing Freddie Mercury's muse.
Mary Austin, right? And for those of you out there who don't know Lucy Boynton, would you like to tell a little about her, where you know her from, and why you love her?
Just everything.
come, tell.
Well, she's in Sing Street, which is an amazing movie, and I love it to pieces, and I make people listen to it when they're in their sleep, so the songs seep into their subconscious, and they love it too.
Shut up. I'm still angry about that.
No, you're not.
Yes.
You love it. And you drive it like you stole it.
Oh. Oh, you're going to get it later for that one.
Yeah,
I do drive it like I stole it. By the way, the Riddle of the Model, freaking love that song. I just wish it was longer.
I know. It's like the greatest Duran Duran song they never recorded, but it's too damn short.
Thank you. There's also, I know her from a movie that she did, a television movie back in like 2007. It was called Ballet Shoes that she did with Emma Watson. Where it's these three orphan girls who are raised by, well, this woman they don't, are really related to. They were just kind of picked up and sheltered. And each one of them has dreams of getting their names in the history books. Emma Watson's character, Pauline, wants to become an actress. And this takes place in the 30s. Lucy's character, Posey, was a daughter of a ballerina and was given a pair of ballet shoes when her mother gave her away. And so she's always wanted to follow that and become a ballerina herself. And their middle sister, Petrova, has a thing for car engines and wants to become a pilot. And so it's just a great little film about following your dreams and stuff like that. But she was also actually in the newest Murder on the Orient Express that we saw.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, she was Countess Helena. I didn't put two and two together because she didn't look like herself.
That's true. And I believe she's also going to be in the upcoming film Apostle.
Yes, she is.
From Gareth Evans, writer-director there. So that's exciting because I always like his stuff.
Oh, Dan Stevens is in it. Another Downton Abbey cast member who moved on to greater and better things. I'm seeing that film now.
And yes, that was five trailers we've looked at this week.
Yeah, that was it's a lot.
It's a big crazy week. We're going to start seeing a lot of trailers now for the second half of the summer, and maybe start seeing some trailers for upcoming award season films as we're getting close to that, as that kicks off in September or so. But before awards season and awards contention can come into the conversation,
let's talk about the death of a particular character in which the audience and Academy are now watching for recognition.
Yes. Of course, we're talking about that Oscar bait film, Deadpool 2, which is going to be our feature review this week. And we'll be back to talk about it in just a moment. popular comic book anti-hero Deadpool made his big screen debut in 2009's X-Men Origins Wolverine. Fans found the script's portrayal of the wisecracking Merc with a Mouth to be far from how he appeared in the comics, and soon he became emblematic of the horrors that studio executives can inflict on comic book properties. No one was more upset, though, than Ryan Reynolds, the actor who played the character and who promised fans he would get the character right on screen the next time. Fast forward 7 years, and Reynolds, along with director Tim Miller, brought Deadpool back to the screen in a solo adventure, which outperformed any expectations that the studio may have initially had for the film. Needless to say, a sequel was quickly ordered up, and now we have Deadpool 2 opening up this weekend. But can the sequel deliver the fun, fourth wall breaks, and surprises that the first film delivered? What did you think, Natasha?
I thought it did.
So you would say this is as good a film as Deadpool?
You're going to hate me. I actually prefer this one over the first one.
Really?
Yeah. Wasn't a big fan of the whole middle section of the first film. With the exception of the montage of, where's Francis? Zamboni. Yeah, that whole middle section in the first film, from when he goes in to go through the transformation, whatever, into superhero, to when they kidnap Vanessa, drove me nuts. I didn't like that whole section there.
Okay, fair enough. Honestly, I feel it's about the same in terms of quality. It's just that certain things, the balance of the elements is different in this film versus the original film.
I feel like this one has more comedy to it.
And that's honestly, and I know it sounds weird for a movie that essentially is a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my problem is with that. I feel like they doubled down on a lot of the same jokes that were a little more subtle in the first film. You know, there's one or two subtle references to Ryan Reynolds' other superhero film, Green Lantern, which did not do well in the first movie. And they really kind of hammer it home in the second film. It's like, oh, you liked that before? Well, we're really going to do a joke about it now. It's
yeah, but they saved it for the end. So I think it's forgiven because, no offense, that mid-credit section is perfect. And I would see the film just for that mid-credit section again. Because I think every fanboy out there needed that.
There's a couple of more things like that. And I mean, it's not as egregious as like how Mike Myers got as the Austin Powers films went on.
Can we not bring up Austin Powers ever again on this podcast? It's happened 3 times already.
Sure.
Okay, good.
But it felt a little bit the same way. It was like, oh, you liked this joke before. Here it is again, but bigger. And I, you know, that kind of didn't sit well with me. Some of the other jokes, the newer material, I'd enjoyed.
Can't draw feet.
Yeah, which is a cheap shot at a comic book artist who shall go nameless. But the second they said it, I knew exactly what they were referencing it, as would any comic book nerd. And that somebody put that joke, that specific joke, into a movie is testament to somebody there is a big comic book nerd. And I would almost guess it was Ryan Reynolds himself who put that one in.
I'm definitely going to say this. Last night when I went and saw it for the second time, the theater erupted into applause at that joke.
So you were in a room full of nerds.
Yeah, I was. Nice. And I was very at home.
Well, when we saw it, you know, it was the first time you saw it, and it was the first time I saw it, I think there was some applause and some good guffaws at that.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think for the first time we saw it, it was just like our row and maybe the row below us that were laughing and applauding at it. This time it was like the whole theater.
Okay.
So you missed out on a good showing.
And and the range of jokes, though, I like, because they go from like an obscure, you know, reference about a comic book artist from the 90s to, you know, referencing a Jack Benny routine, which I loved because I'm a huge Jack Benny fan for years. And the second I heard that, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that, you know, they're using this. And, you know, so that made me happy. And there was a couple of other people, I think, at that screening we were at together where you heard some guffaws. So I think a few other people recognized that as well.
I lost it over the Basic Instinct joke.
There's a Basic Instinct joke. Yeah, there's a lot of pop culture referencing there. maybe not quite as thick as your average Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, but very close. And if you miss a reference, you don't get what they're referencing, don't worry. There's another one, you know, on right its way within 7 seconds.
Yeah, it's true. It does. Plus, I feel like this one blends the drama a little better, given the circumstances surrounding this film's story arc.
True. I would say this has a stronger story arc, actually.
Yeah. Which is probably another reason why I prefer this one over the first one. The first one felt like your average, oh, I want revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my girlfriend was kidnapped. I need to save her kind of deal. This is your usual
standard plot.
Yeah, standard superhero plot. Where this one, it also slightly feels standard, but it takes a whole different twist on the standard.
It's the person dealing with a painful moment that's inflicted on them. And we're trying to keep this semi-spoilery free, so we'll leave it at that, I guess. And so for that, I liked it. You know, it gave the film, I think, even a bigger emotional resonance than the first film had. Does it do a whole lot with it? Yes and no.
I think it does enough to make everything relevant, to make that that pain resonate, not just with the audience, but with Deadpool himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like Cable says at one point, you use humor to cover up the pain that you're in. So the more pain you're in, the more jokes you're going to crack. And Rich, this is the only time I'm ever going to do this on the podcast. Hmm. You should know that better than anyone.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. I would say definitely. I think a lot of people do that, though. Use humor to mask their pain or to blunt the edge of things like that.
And therefore, I'm not surprised that this one has more jokes and more comedy. He's trying at any cost to make people laugh. Not just the people in the film, but the audience themselves. Because I don't feel like the merc with the mouth would be too proud of people feeling sorry for him.
No.
Even the audience. And he knows the audience is watching. That's the whole point of the fourth wall break.
Well, let me ask you this. Does a Deadpool movie need to start off with, okay, what kind of heaping tragedy can we, you know, drop on his head in the first act in order to get things going? Does a Deadpool movie always need to start with something bad happening to him? Or can it just be an adventure and he's wisecracking his way through it, but something horrible doesn't need to happen right at the, you know, in the first 15 minutes?
I don't think it needs it, but I think it helps his arc. It makes him more human. I'm a member of the generation who didn't know Deadpool until we saw him in Origins Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
Shush.
I wasn't going to say anything.
You were thinking the judgment over there. I could hear it. I could hear it. Because I wasn't that big into comic books at the time. That came a little later on. Mm-hmm. That came like a couple years later. So I didn't really understand the character. I didn't understand his kind of comedy. And it felt like Deadpool was just kind of an off branch of Ryan Reynolds' character from Blade Trinity.
That's kind of a proto Deadpool character, yeah. I guess.
And I guess when it came around time for the actual Deadpool movie, I sat down, I went through some of, you know, Deadpool's comics, I read up on the character, I went back and watched Origins, and I was sitting there going, oh god, this is a piece of shit film.
Yep. Notice it's one of two X-Men films that are not on my shelf.
Are you what's the other one?
X3.
Oh yeah, X3, that's right, yeah. I forgot about that. That's just how memorable that film is. I completely forgot about it. But I did my research, and then I went and saw the film, and I said to myself, okay, I understand him now. I understand his pain. And in fact, the piece in Deadpool where him and Vanessa, within like first 20 seconds of them meeting, they're comparing the tragedies in their life. Mm-hmm. His life is built on tragedy. And that's what makes him so lovable, is because, like Van Gogh, he takes the pain of his life and turns it into beauty somehow. It's a fucked up, twisted beauty of, of jokes and blood and sex, but yep. It's beauty. Mm-hmm. And it's his type of beauty. And that's why him and Vanessa work so well together, is that they understand each other. They have shared life experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I like that. Now, let me ask you this, though. Can a movie that really kind of traded on subverting expectations have a sequel that also really subverts expectations? Or are you sitting there going, well, this is going to go sideways really soon in a way that doesn't seem regular? I'm talking specifically about his pulling together a super team, calling it X-Force, and then them embarking on their first mission. It definitely subverts expectations, but at the same time, I sort of saw that coming.
I did not see that coming. I was hoping for X-Force as what we saw in the trailer. And mm-hmm. I will be the first to admit I didn't see that coming. And I was completely shocked sitting in the theater. I'm like, what the hell just happened?
Okay.
But I sort of understand it as well. Sitting there watching them going through their interviews and stuff, you've got big name characters, but you're sitting there going, those aren't the ones he's going to connect with. It doesn't seem like he's even trying to connect with them. He seems like he's not even trying to lead them. He's commanding them and saying, jump off the plane.
Yeah.
And then you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. I will say that, you know, some of those characters are from that mid-90s Marvel era that I just really just don't like at all. Okay, I actively hate. Because everything was extreme. And to see a shitty character like Shatterstar get what happens to him, it just, that's what made me laugh. I was like, yeah, fuck you, Shatterstar, goodbye. I know, I'm terrible, and I apologize to all four Shatterstar fans out there, but you know,
four.
I know, I'm overestimating.
I don't know enough about his character to care, to be honest.
He's from a planet called Mojo World, for goodness sakes. This is a terrible character.
Mojo World. Ugh. It's the best that they could do. It's like an anime porno. I gotta get my mojo back. Oh, come here.
Come to Mojo World.
Oh, God.
And then tentacles appear. Okay, I may cut some of that.
No, don't cut it. It's brilliant.
Okay.
So there's that.
So, yes.
I was a big fan of Peter.
Yes, Peter was awesome.
Zeitgeist. Thoughts on Zeitgeist? Mixed.
The rest of the original X-Force is kind of a blank slate, really. I mean, there are one or two jokes that are good, but nothing about them is memorable. Hey, Terry Crews, awesome. Terry Crews is in this. Hey, by the way, Brooklyn Nine-Nine renewed. Yay! You know, so there's that, and
Bill
Domino.
Skarsgård as Zeitgeist comes in, and you're mm-hmm. sitting there going, "What is Pennywise doing out of his makeup?" And he's not scaring me. He looks hot. Go away.
I wasn't thinking all of that, but
I was. Okay. But you know,
but
not all of us
Domino
belong in Mojo World.
Domino's.
Domino.
Domino's fantastic, I thought.
Yes.
The way they orchestrated everything that goes on around her. That was something that could really have fallen apart in the edit and how they portray her powers. But it really worked really well. So that's probably like one of the best bits. And I think that's because the new director is one of the co-directors from the first two John Wick films. So I think, you know, he brought that kind of stylized, highly choreographed action, you know, to bear right here with those segments.
And one of my favorites, Atomic Blonde. Check out the stairwell fight.
Oh, good gosh, yes.
And speaking of Bill Skarsgård, he was in that.
That's right.
Yeah. And they actually make a joke about that.
Join us next week on the Bill Skarsgård podcast when we...
we talk about Hemlock Grove.
No, thank you.
Oh, damn it. It was worth a shot.
And I think Zazie Beetz, I've heard it pronounced Zazie Beetz. I've heard it pronounced 14 different ways, her first name.
Really? Because I've not even heard what it sounds like from anyone, so you're the first.
When I first heard it was Zazie, and I was like, yeah, Zazie. I like that. That's a great... So we're going with Zazie. So Zazie Beetz's character work is fantastic. She seems to be having a lot of fun. I can see where, you know, they wanted to bring her in, so they did some reshoots and added some more of her character in. There's still not enough for me, I guess, which is a good thing. You know,
makes you want to see more of her in the next one.
More, yes, yeah. In the X-Force movie or whatever we get next.
Thoughts on the kid?
The kid's character seemed a little one note to me. He's okay, but I don't think he's not the strongest actor in the ensemble.
Well, no, but he's a kid. He's a kid.
So I don't want to be too harsh about it, you know?
I mean, I give him credit for trying to hold his own against, you know, heavyweights such as Josh Brolin, Ryan Reynolds,
mm-hmm.
even Eddie Marson, who's just in the background.
Mm-hmm. But I thought he was good in Taika Waititi's Hunt for the Wilder People from about 2 years ago or last year.
I didn't even see that.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's on Hulu. I would recommend people checking it out. It's the movie he did right before Thor Ragnarok.
Mm.
And he's good in that. So judging by those two performances, this is not his best performance. We'll say that.
All right. But do you think he's one we should watch out for over the coming years?
I would need to see some more work from him first. Honestly, I would need to see another film or two. I mean, Taika Waititi could have really directed the hell out of him to get that performance in Hunt for the Wilder People. And here, maybe he just didn't have as good direction or as good guidance. He seemed very one note, yelly, yelly, yelly. There was not a whole lot of subtle shading to what he was doing.
I did love the whole section of, what does he have that I don't? Don't say like, bop, 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 bop. Then he flips him off and goes, legs.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was delivered perfectly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the kid's got some good comic timing and everything.
Yeah. But so, everything else, it felt like he overplayed it, maybe, in some sections?
Maybe a little, but that also might be a factor of the script, too. The script might not have been giving him a whole lot to work with.
Or maybe that was kind of the point. I mean, he's going through his teenage angst phase.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be honest, I sort of understood what they were going for with that character. He's not supposed to be multi-layered. He's one-track mind. That's kind of a teenage thing.
He's kind of just a one-note character, and we're kind of left to impose our own memories of our own teen angstdom up against it.
Yeah.
To fill that in. Because if so, I don't think that's great filmmaking, honestly.
No, it's not. But a lot of the biggest moviegoers in this demographic now are between... particularly for what Deadpool is trying to reach out to, is somewhere between the ages of 17 and maybe between 35 and 38. So they're in a demographic in which you're not too far off from remembering what that was mm-hmm. like, or you have teenagers who are going through that at that moment. So at that point, you're sitting there going, okay, yeah, I know exactly what this kid's doing, because I've got an angsty 14-year-old at home right now doing the exact same thing, and it's still annoying the shit out of me even now as it does at home. So I think that's kind of what they were going for, is they were trying to reach out to that. You're not supposed to pull from your own so much as watching everyone else around you going through it.
Okay.
You don't have kids, so you you obviously can't say that you can see that going on a day-to-day basis.
I thought you were going to say you've missed out on that, and I was like, nope, don't miss it at all.
But yeah, so I sort of get it. I do.
Okay.
Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin. Is there any Marvel villain he can't play?
I'm going to just say, when he showed up on screen for the first time in Deadpool, the first thing I did was I flipped off the screen. Because after the events of Infinity War...
You are still hung up on Infinity War, aren't you?
After the events of Infinity War, I am just really pissed off at him right now. I couldn't even really... I mean, I liked him as Cable. I loved him as Cable. But I loved Cable, not Josh Brolin.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I flipped him off just because he was given Mikey stick 30 years ago about looking for One-Eyed Willie's treasure, and he was against it, so he turned out to be wrong there. Josh Brolin.
Which they do make a joke of in the film.
That's true.
Bring it on, One-Eyed Willie. Like, yes.
Yep. And that reference works on two levels, because obviously, you know, Cable has the eye patch, as well as referencing...
He's like Terminator-eyed.
Terminator-eye, excuse me. As well as you know, being in the Goonies. So that kind of works to its...
Plus, am I the only one who's sitting there when he's staring at himself in the mirror shirtless, who's sitting there going, they pulled that from Terminator.
Oh, the Cable's whole origin is basically a Terminator riff. Again, 90s comics from Marvel, not too original, but extreme. And yeah, so that was them basically saying, let's do our own Terminator story. And the movie quotes, visually quotes Terminator about three times, I think.
No, I only caught one.
There was one or two ones that I was kind of like, ah.
There was the scene, and then Deadpool makes a joke about some John Connor asshole or something like that.
The movie is very blatant about acknowledging that Cable is a Terminator ripoff.
Yeah, even when he comes back in time, and the first thing he sees is two hillbilly rednecks out sitting on the back of their pickup truck drinking beer, and he takes the beer, knocks them out, and drives off with the truck. I'm like, well, first of all, you arrived in the middle of the desert. This is definitely Terminator.
Yeah, it's very much a riff where, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger arrives, beats up the punks, and steals their motorcycle. It's only a shame that Bill Paxton is no longer with us.
Yeah.
Because he would have been wonderful in that scene, and that would have made it even funnier.
By the way, did you catch who those two, the actors playing those two hillbilly rednecks are?
One was Alan Tudyk.
One was Alan Tudyk. The other one was Matt Damon.
What, Matt Damon?
Yeah, apparently.
How many more Marvel movies is Matt Damon going to be in?
And the funny part is he doesn't look like him.
I know. Technically, it's not a Marvel movie. It's an X-Men movie co-produced with Marvel. Blah, blah, blah. But good for Matt Damon. I like Matt Damon having a good sense of humor and just popping up and stuff.
Yeah. So there's Matt Damon. And there's a bunch of other cameos in this film that are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, keep your eye out for The Vanisher.
Yes. Yes. That was an enjoyable little surprise. Were there any other notes about this film you wanted to hit?
The opening, as in the opening credits.
Oh, yes. That was delightful.
The moment he stood up, I saw the flames around him. I'm going, they're not. I was already laughing last night at that point. And it wasn't until the big circle of cream cheese spreaders comes down around him and everyone else finally got it in the theater and started laughing. Should we kind of say what that is?
It's a delightful riff on the James Bond films. Most, you know, some of the more recent opening segments.
It feels like they were stealing it from a mixture of Skyfall and I caught Skyfall, I caught Spectre, and I caught actually Goldeneye sitting on his hand.
Yeah.
Laying on his hand in the shape of a gun. Mm-hmm. So that one came straight from Goldeneye. But in the background, music by Celine Dion.
Yes. There's some interesting and inspired musical choices, and that's all I'm going to say.
Dubstep.
Outside of the fact that this is the first movie score album to ever carry a parental warning on it.
Not surprised.
I'm not talking about the soundtrack with like the pop songs and everything. I'm talking the orchestral score, and you'll realize it when you hear it in the movie.
Yes, there is a wonderful Gregorian chant. That's all we're going to say. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
Well, yeah, I do. I do think right now with 20th Century Fox's future kind of in limbo, we're still waiting to find out if all the regulatory hurdles are being cleared for Disney to absorb them. We were supposed to get 3 X-Men movies this year. We were supposed to get New Mutants earlier in the year, and then X-Men Dark Phoenix later this summer. And because of reshoots on those two films, those have been pushed back into next year. So this is really the only X-Men feature we're going to get for the foreseeable future. And after those other two films come out, might be the end of the 20th Century Fox X-Men franchise before all those characters get shuffled back over to Marvel Studios if Fox gets absorbed into Disney. So do you think they're going out on a good note here? Or are you a little disappointed that we're not going to see more of any of this stuff?
Well, as they said in the I think it was the first trailer for Deadpool 2, stop at 2. Yeah, we probably won't even make it to 3. Stop at 2. You killed it.
And of course, there was that trilogy joke in X-Men Apocalypse, too.
Oh yes, with the they went to see Return of the Jedi.
Yeah,
yeah.
Everybody knows the third movie's always the weakest.
Yeah, I forgot about that because it's been a while since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember liking that film. I saw it twice in the cinema, and I actually did like it.
I like it. I don't love it. I don't think it's the best X-Men film.
No, it's not the best. The but I, franchise. If I remember correctly, after you picked it up out of like the $10 or $5 bin or whatever, you came home, you rewatched, and you said, I remember liking this a lot more than I did when I sat in the theater. You never actually clarified why.
I don't know. Maybe I was going in with higher expectations into the theater just because I thought Days of Future Past was so good.
Oh, Days
and First
of
Class was really good.
Mm-hmm.
They're right, you know, as the third trilogy of, you know, the new, you know, of a new X-Men trilogy as the third installment, Apocalypse is not the best, but it's still a decent movie. It's still fine. I know some fandom gets all up in knots because Apocalypse doesn't look exactly like he does in the comics. But I, for one, don't think those little lines coming off of his mouth that make him look like a ventriloquist dummy are that important to the character of Apocalypse. That's just me, though.
I actually liked Oscar Isaac as Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. He's not... And I'm suffering here from lack of comic book knowledge. But as a performance, I like the idea of this guy who thinks he's God is so small. Therefore, he surrounds himself with people with so many powers around him, not just because he's trying to absorb as much as possible to be pretty much become a god, but even a god needs acolytes.
Mm-hmm.
He needs followers, people to worship him, people to adore him. And it feels like someone with a god complex might be someone who is slightly emasculated, and therefore someone who acts bigger than what they actually are. I liked the performance that he gave. You didn't think about it like that, did you?
No, but I like that analysis. I do like that analysis a lot. And well, that about wraps us up for this week.
Remember that you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes and Stitcher. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, please leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners.
And we'll be back next week with more news analysis and a review of Solo, A Star Wars Story. And that's here on the Big Picture Podcast.